I'm Neil.
I'm Louise.
And I'm Ronnie.
I'm Daisy's dad.
I'm Daisy's mum.
And I'm Daisy's grandpa.
In 2018, Daisy was diagnosed with regressive autism.
She gradually lost all of her speech and began to show some typical autistic traits.
She'd spin in circles, avoid eye contact, and make loud monotone noises.
This was a big shock, as up until this point, Daisy had been speaking in 7 or 8 word sentences.
And had memorised pretty much 20 to 30 books.
Since then, we've all been on a journey of discovery.
In this podcast, we'll talk about that journey.
And explore how autism has changed all of us.
This is the story of Daisy.
And me.
Episode 4, Normals.
Right, let's just stop there for a minute right away. What is normals then? Normals with an S.
Well, it's like the plural of like what your normal is.
What?
Everyone's got a different, everyone has a different
Why
normal.
Is everybody adding things?
I questioned the grammar as
well.
Well,
no, but everyone's got a normal, but what's a collective term for all of those normals?
Normal.
Normals.
Isn't just normal.
No.
No, it's, okay, it's about the experience of what is normal for people. As
right.
in their experience of life and things like that.
Normal then.
I mean, yeah. You can tell why normal. We've been away for so long, can't you?
Anyway, welcome to the Daisy and Me podcast. We've got a great guest today.
Kathy Wassell, who is the CEO of the Autistic Girls Network. Really, really fascinating and really, really goes into a lot about sort of education and girls being underdiagnosed and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, really, really interesting.
What kind of time are we having with Daisy at the moment? I don't know why I asked that question, because I know she's been a bit uncomfortable going to school lately.
Yeah. Mm,
it has been challenging, hasn't it?
We've had a bit of a spell. It's been going on for a few months where initially we thought that it was to do with school uniform because she just started not wanting to put her school uniform on. So we transitioned her into colours of the school uniform, but jogging bottoms, hoodie, so all stuff that she's used to wearing, but in school uniform colours. And it's just been ongoing, and what we've realised is that it's not the school uniform, it's the association of the clothes with school. So getting to school and getting out the door in the morning has been quite a challenge. There's been quite a lot of changes at school, and yeah, we're hoping there's been lots of conversation, so I think hopefully things are starting to settle. And she has seemed a little bit happier the last couple of weeks.
I think with any changes, we just notice there's a bit of a sort of fallout with Daisy.
Yeah.
Is that you can change one thing one day and then she might seem okay, but we won't have the fallout until a week after
there's
or 2 weeks after.
Effect, right. Isn't
and
it?
you just notice that when lots of things all change at once, the fallout gets bigger.
Yeah.
I had a wee bit of a flashback with her. I remember many years ago, I took her out on a Sunday afternoon and we went down to Costa's and she didn't want to go into Costa's. She wanted to go up to the cinema. So we went up to the cinema and it wasn't open. So it must have been, I don't know what, but anyway, she just kicked off and she was crying. She'd never done that with me before and really real proper kind of meltdown for that point. So when it went on. Other day there, I picked her up from school and grandma wasn't with me, it was just me, and I picked her up and came out and she was upset. She put herself on the floor, lay on the floor. But I remembered Sky, our therapist, saying, Daisy, this is time just to take a deep breath. And I said this to her, she was lying on the floor. They said, Daisy, let's just take a deep breath. Will you take a deep breath for me? And she stopped.
Yeah.
And she took a breath and she looked at me so straight in the eye and she came back up and we started. She wasn't 100%, but she actually just calmed herself down. And I've noticed as well that when she's upset, she's actually playing stuff in the... Oh, I give her the phone for the car and she'll play these nursery rhymes, which are very calm.
Yeah.
And she goes to those.
That's soporific.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like it grounds her. We've had... an incident, there was a day, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, where you'd taken her out in the morning and it was just awful in the shop, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then I took her out in the afternoon. We popped into the shop. She's normally really good in the supermarket. It was absolutely manic. I think it was the day before Mother's Day.
Yeah.
And she had probably the biggest sensory meltdown that I've ever had with her, or seen her have in the supermarket when I've been with her. And it was just, it was awful. Mm. You could just, I just felt for her and I realised that she was just so overloaded, and then I felt really guilty, but I didn't know what to do with her because she was just on the floor, and she went on the floor several times. She nearly fell out the trolley at one point because she was sitting in the trolley, and it was just the eyes. I could just feel everyone staring, and I know I have to shut that out, but I just found it really, really difficult. Mm.
Well, I noticed. I just swear at them.
Yeah. Oh, I just go Scottish. What are you looking at? On your bike. Nothing to see here.
I think it's because I wanted to help her in that moment. Yeah. I was saying to her, I'm so sorry, Daisy. I know this is too much. Let's get you out of here as quickly as possible, because we'd paid, but it was almost too late. She needed to go through that meltdown before we could even get her out of the shop.
You two must do this as well. Whenever you tell us about things that have happened, you immediately go into an analysis. Right, and you're saying there that, you know, some kind might have happened, a change might have happened a week ago, but you're actually, you're temporal, you're looking at what's happening now and thinking, oh, that's what's caused it, and it might not be that.
Yeah, it might, it could be anything.
Lots of other things contributing,
So it's been a busy few weeks.
Yeah.
He's pumped up, he just needs to move now.
Yeah. That's Coach Beach Holiday.
That's Coach Beach Holiday? Wow, yeah.
But on the good side, Voca.
Voca, yeah.
Oh, it's so Voca.
It is Voca.
Voca.
Yeah.
We're really going to have to watch you with this, aren't we? Because if you... I mean, if she learns that word from you because you're mispronouncing it...
Vocal.
Voca.
Voca.
Voca. Why is it not...
V-O-C-A.
Yeah. Why is it not vocal then? Voca.
So it's a voice-operated communication aid. But it's Voca.
But it enables her to be vocal.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but it's called Voca.
That's the abbreviation.
Because there isn't an L.
No, but I'm saying, anyway.
No, but she's, so we've got this box now, and she's really using it really, really well. And
she is. We're having to model it, but we're trying to infiltrate it into our everyday communication without forcing her to use it.
Just talk about the modelling for a second, for anybody who doesn't want these contraptions.
Yeah, so modelling is where we're showing her the construction of the sentence by directing. It's sort of, sometimes we're putting it in on the device and showing her where to find things, and other times it's sort of hand over hand modelling and getting her, and sometimes she's finding stuff without us even doing that. But we're trying to show her how to have a conversation using the Voca, so that she can think, oh, okay, that's how you do it. So she's used to her book and it is different. It's going to take quite a long time. But yeah, we've already had some quite magic moments, haven't we?
It's quite interesting with the modelling thing, and with this device. Obviously, we've got the low tech version, which is just her book that she rifles through the pages, and that's too big now. So that's why we've gone over to the device. But it's really interesting when you think about the way you've got to teach a child like Daisy, who's non-speaking. All of the words on that are most of them are in her head. She can't get them out, but we've got to teach her how to find them on this. So it's not about teaching her the word, it's about teaching her where it is.
But actually, we're probably not, I was saying about hand over hand, we're not. The only time we're hand over hand is if she's sort of hesitant, because you can see she's scanning and she's struggling. We're sort of just gently directing her. But actually, what we've found is just leaving it next to her, she is finding stuff herself, isn't she? She's babbling. Actually just babbling with it, which is brilliant.
That's
so
nice.
So well, there was one moment yesterday. She's the cartoon Bing. She quite likes that occasionally. And she put it in three times. So it went bing, bing, bing. Bing. I thought someone had set a bell off.
Round two.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it feels like it feels like a big step forward. I walked around Sainsbury's this morning with Daisy and took it with me. And she's just using it. And, you know, people are hearing this voice and they're looking, but it's not the look. It's not that horrible look.
No,
they're just intrigued. You know, why is she saying
curiosity,
Mummy Beach, Pepper, like all in one sentence?
Yes.
Mummy Beach, Pepper, Bing. Drain.
Chips burger.
Chips burger. Oh, yeah, she asked for chips burger, yeah. Oh, she hit burger a couple of times this morning. Burger, burger. And I just sort of went, do you actually want to eat a burger? And she sort of didn't answer, so I thought, no, you're just saying it.
You know? No, I know where the word is now, so I'm going to use it.
Yeah. But I think what Skye was saying, because we were sort of talking about how she just keeps pressing lots of random words, but actually her therapist was saying that's a really normal thing for children to do. And actually the Casey team that have supplied this, the speech and language therapy department, have actually said that it's quite normal. It's an exploratory thing. So I think she's sort of doing all the right things at the moment, isn't she?
What are you doing at the moment?
Good.
Good? It's good, yeah?
Good.
Good. What is this, though? What's that? Can you find it? Yeah? Where's it go?
Here.
Oh, no, hold on, look. Remember? So it's in...
Puzzle. Good puzzle.
You're doing a good puzzle? Good job.
And there is that very, very nice little link that you did there, Louise. Normals.
Normals.
That is now the new normal for us, is that we have got to introduce that. But we were thinking about it, you know, off the back of Kathy's interview, is we're constantly changing what's normal.
Yeah.
We're always adapting. I mean, every day is a different type of normal. And it's just about constantly being driven by what she wants or is feeling or anything like that.
But it's our normal, isn't it? So it is adapting and changing constantly, which I think being a parent to any child you do, because it's all a learning curve, but it is throwing out what was the norm before and our expectations, because this is our new normal. This is normal for us.
And the new normal might become the old normal, which could become the new normal again, that kind of cyclical thing.
Yeah.
Where it's, you know, like just the kind of analogy is when she gets into a particular kind of puzzle and she does the puzzle again, back to front, upside down, the whole thing, then maybe goes off with that and then comes back. The one of the things we've really enjoyed when she's been overseen is she's starting to play with things on her own now.
Yeah.
She's getting toys out and just playing with them, and we just leave her alone. And she's kind of just putting things in and playing with some of the sort of bricks and things. And it's, you think that's what she was doing before we got the diagnosis.
Mm.
And it's almost like she's...
Things come back in waves, don't
they?
Yeah. It's interesting because I don't feel... And it's obviously she's 7 now.
Mm.
So there was that bit just after she was born where you sort of had to really readjust everything that you thought was going to happen. I don't feel any like I've lost anything now.
No. If anything, we've gained lots, I think, haven't we? There are still times when you there's always going to be periods of I don't want to use the word sadness, because then it sounds like life is negative, and it's not. There are always going to be things that you feel sad about because it's more of a challenge for her, or she's going to have to fight that bit harder and we're having to fight harder. But I think we've actually gained more
than
we've
completely
lost. I know that sounds...
Well, apart from you, Nell, because you're losing some hair at the moment, which is really quite encouraging for me. I quite like the fact that I might end up with more hair than you, which is...
Well, you know, I work harder, so...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You do half an hour of radio and TV news. Oh, that's hard.
Yeah, it must be hard talking for a living. That must be really difficult.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I've got to hit buttons at the right time.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Shall we get to our guest?
Yeah, let's do that.
I think we're better.
So you spoke to Kathy Wassell from the Autistic Girls Network a few weeks back.
Here she is. The Autistic Girls Network, one of the things you said in an interview was that you set it up, one of the reasons you set it up is you wanted to make sure that other families didn't go through what you had gone through. Can we talk about what you'd gone through with your children?
We can talk about it in a general way.
Yeah.
I don't talk about any specifics because it's not my story to tell.
Right.
But yes, it was a difficult time. We only kind of discovered that my child was autistic when they were in the throes of a massive mental health crisis, basically. And at that point, it became very obvious that the system that we have in this country, and to be fair, probably in every country, is just not up to the job. And there is such a lack of understanding. And it probably has got a little bit better. Well, no, it definitely has got a little bit better in the last 5 years. But at that time, the things that I know now, I still feel like the professionals should have known. And my children now have multiple neurodivergent diagnoses, none of which were picked up on or referred by any professionals. And, you know, even when you've been under CAMHS for 2 years already, then I feel like it's not a good thing, shall we say, to have not picked up on any of those other neurodivergencies either. So yeah, that's where we are.
It's interesting as well, Kathy, because the late diagnosis, particularly in girls, it's usually as an event has happened, a mental health crisis, as a result of a non-diagnosis, and that's more or less what you were saying there. Yeah. And I wonder how prevalent you think that maybe is from your experience with the charity.
I think that, we'll put it this way, there's almost 14,000 people in our Facebook group. The vast majority of those will have children who were late diagnosed. It's not always girls. So we don't talk about a female presentation of autism. We talk about an internal presentation of autism. So that could be boys, could be non-binary young people. But however, it tends to be fairly common in girls or those brought up as girls. And if you were brought up as a girl and you were diagnosed very early, then it's likely that you don't present in that way. It's likely you have a more external presentation of autism. And actually, it was quite illuminating. I'm doing my dissertation at the moment, and I'm doing it on the checklist that's part of our white paper that we published about this time last year, actually, because it was on International Women's Day. And that white paper is on an internal presentation of autism. And in the middle, there's a checklist of different kind of segments, you know. So there's a section on friendship, there's a section on emotional, there's a section on sensory stuff, and that checklist has various statements in with kind of how you might present if you have an internal presentation. And I was doing an interview yesterday with a 15-year-old who told me that she didn't mask her autism. She wasn't diagnosed until she was maybe 9 or 10, but she said, I don't mask my autism. And actually, we went through the checklist and she didn't agree with quite a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And at the time I thought, this is the first person I've spoken to that's not agreeing with a lot of the checklist. And then when I thought about it, I thought, well, she told me that she didn't mask, so I wouldn't expect her to come under, you know, a lot of the items that are in that checklist. So that was quite interesting, actually.
On that point about knowledge of autism, and we've heard about the government initiative to, you know, what is it, 33 new special schools. They're hoping to get £10 billion worth of grant. But I want to go right back to something you said, I think it was on your website, you're talking about the lack of training for people in schools to spot autism and then to engage with that child. And second question on that as well, Cathy, is how far away then, if we teachers were trained and could cope and knew how to deal with teaching an autistic child, would we have more children in mainstream education? I hate using the word mainstream, but you know what I mean. Do you think we'd have more?
We already have. The vast majority of autistic children are in mainstream now. Over 70% of autistic children are in mainstream school now. Are they all happy in mainstream school? Undoubtedly, no, they're not. I mean, I'm sure if you collected any segment of the teenage population, I'm sure a lot of them wouldn't be happy in school either. But among the cohort of neurodivergent pupils, particularly, there is a large amount of selective mutism. There is a large amount of emotionally based school avoidance. Would they be happier somewhere else? Yes, quite possibly. Is that a special school? For some of them, no, it's not. Because what we need is almost a three, I don't want to use the word tier system, but I can't think of another word at the moment. We need a system with three strands, if you like. We need a strand in the middle, which I guess is what they're trying to do with autism hubs in mainstream school. Certainly in my area, that's all they want to do, is they want more hubs in mainstream. But that doesn't solve what is often the biggest issue for a lot of the autistic pupils who are in mainstream currently, which is that school can be a toxic place for them. This, the school environment with big secondary schools with thousands of pupils, with fluorescent lights, with having to go down corridors of hell, as I call them, every hour, with so many different teachers who often don't understand them or haven't read their EHCP or their education plan, with all the sensory stuff that goes with lots of people and lots of noise, lots of touching and jostling in the corridors and smells of cooking, etc. All of that is not something that you can really change in a big school that's got thousands of pupils in it. And it isn't realistic for us to expect schools to change, all of that. But how can they? If you've got a school, in Birmingham, for example, that's got 4,000 pupils in it, there is realistically a limited amount that you can do to mitigate the environment. There's lots of other things you can do. There's lots of things you can do about differentiating. Well, I'm not sure that word is in vogue now, but yes. Anyway, teaching according to the needs of the pupil, you can certainly do that, but you can't change the fact that there's 4,000 young people there. And so what we really need is kind of a middle strand, if you like, where you can have a mainstream curriculum, but it's an environment that is tolerable for young people who can't tolerate a mainstream placement. There are very, very few of those around at the moment, and they tend to be kind of nurturing, tiny schools. My daughter went to one, only had 30 pupils. So, you can tell that there aren't going to be many that can get in there. Oh, here the dogs arrive, and they're not meant to be here. Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
So what we really need is more schools like that, where the young people are in an environment that they can tolerate. They still may not love it, but they can tolerate it. And they are able to get a mainstream, what you may call a mainstream curriculum education. I'm thinking of, when I think of the special school that's in my area, the main, the core special school that's in my area, you can do GCSEs there, but you can't do A-levels, for example. And so you would have to go, well, they do have to go somewhere else. And actually there isn't anywhere else post 16. There's just college. That's all there is. So you have to leave that environment of a special school or a specialist school, in my daughter's case, and you have to go to a mainstream college. Yeah. And so again, you've got all of the environment that made it impossible for you to go to your secondary school in the first place. So that's another situation that's really difficult.
Yeah, the one of the things I'm really proud of Neil and Lou, Daisy's parents, because they've fought. In fact, one of our early podcasts, Kathy, we were told, you'll have to fight. This is a fight all the way through. And I've seen them, they're filling out the forms and everything and getting advice. And I worried, and I've said it so many times on podcasts ad nauseum, I worry about the people who can't fill the forms out, who struggle with advice. They don't have a network to go to, because they, in the middle of the night, they're hoping their child can get a placement at this school, which is only got 18 places. And there's, 80 people trying to get into it. And I wonder where those people go and what help's available if they can't get their child into their school.
Well, I mean, I think the first problem is that a lot of people don't even know that that's actually an option. And so, you know, in order to get an advocate to help you, you have to know that that is a possibility in the first place. So there's that. Then, you know, obviously a lot of, well, probably half or more parents of a neurodivergent child are going to be neurodivergent themselves. They may have a lot of trauma about their own school days because they probably also had a pretty bad time at school. That's a massive generalization, of course. They won't all have done, but some of them may have. And there just isn't really much available advice out there. There are advocates. I don't want to name individuals on here, but there are some good advocates. And if people post in our group, then they will be recommended. You do have to pay for them, of course. There are CENDIAS services in every area. That's statutory to be available in every area. However, they are meant to be independent, but they are paid for by the local authority. And their efficiency, you know, really varies according to area. So you may be in an area that's got a really good CENDIAS and you may not. So, you know, again, that's a little bit mixed. And also you have to know about them in the first place. I haven't heard of many schools, for example, sending parents to CENDIAS because often CENDIAS have to get involved, or an advocate has to get involved, when there's actually friction between parents and school. So school are unlikely to recommend them, although in some cases, of course, they might. But that would be your first port of call, would be your local CENDIAS. And then if that didn't work out and they were too busy or they just had no capacity because they're very underfunded, then you would go to another advocacy service. But again, you have to know how they exist in the first place. You have to have some funds. Most of them are not hugely expensive, but again, what's hugely expensive to me might be impossible to somebody else.
That was precisely my point. Talking about the girls' network, what about the parents and grandparents? And, you know, obviously I'm a grandparent and really lucky to be involved with Daisy as much as I am. But what about parents and grandparents growing up and learning, as I'm learning so much from Daisy? What about them learning and getting on with their life with an autistic girl in the family?
Well, we actually had a few months ago, we had an 83-year-old woman join our Facebook group who had just got her diagnosis, and she had gone for diagnosis because her daughter and her granddaughter were diagnosed autistic. Wow. And then she realised that she was too, which is much more common than you might think, because your normal is your normal in your life. And so the way that you do things is the way that you think everyone else does things until you realise that it's not. That's actually really common, usually more common for parents than for grandparents, but it's very common to realise your own neurodivergence later in life. I would say to grandparents, read up as much as you can. We're getting a new website soon. We're having a new website built, as we got a grant for it very nicely. And we will have a section for grandparents, because I think it's really important that you are involved in your grandchild's life. But I also think it's really important that you understand your grandchild. And to do that, you are going to have to do some research, and you probably are going to have to throw out your parenting methods as well, because they probably won't work. So you're going to have to throw all that out and learn again how to parent, especially if your autistic grandchild is very demand avoidant. You need to chuck out everything that you thought was right and start learning again.
It's so true, Cathy, because as I said, we're learning from Daisy, and the things she's getting is, you know, she's directing us, and it's brilliant in that respect. Can we talk just, I mentioned there about the whole thing about the government launching this new money and things. $10 billion is not a lot, right, in the scale of things. It sounds like a lot.
Well, not for schools, no.
and you were talking about that. Have we ever, do you think we'll ever, because you said right at the start, very positively, that you know, there's much more awareness about autism, much more awareness about autism in girls and diagnosis of that. But are we ever going to get to a stage where it is properly funded? It is an area of education and development that governments, whether it's this one or the next one, actually see that this is a priority that they have to deal with?
Well, it's interesting that I see quite a lot of emphasis now. If we're kind of looking at the other end of the scale for adults, I'm seeing quite a lot of emphasis on neurodiversity in business and the value of having neurodivergent employees, et cetera, et cetera. And I see quite, you know, I see government figures involved in that. And it's, I think it's all part of what is trying to happen is the way that maybe some people think that it will be better funded is to build up the idea of what a neurodivergent adult can do for you. And I have mixed feelings about this because I think it puts a lot of pressure on autistic people to be some kind of, you know, superhero type person. And of course, everyone's different. Some people are really great at some things. Some people are not so great at other things. All of us, no matter what our neurotype.
Yes.
And yeah, it makes me slightly uncomfortable, this emphasis on neurodiversity in business. However, it probably will end up getting us more funding for things like assessments. There are some areas that are trying really hard. My area, for example, is trying really hard. They are only trying really hard because they failed their SEND inspection. And it was one of their written statements of action that they had to improve on. However, they have really grasped it and they are really trying to improve. They had a waiting list of 5 years last year or year before, and it definitely is going down quite rapidly. However, this year, or the last half of 2022, there was a huge jump in referrals, in autism referrals. So they are kind of racing to catch up with that. And I think that is, I mean, it's difficult because there are no national figures. You can't just go and pluck out these figures nationally. They're not recorded. So whether it's happening in every area or not, I don't know. But I think generally referrals are up. And of course, that's not good news for waiting lists. If areas are really throwing a lot of money into it, like my area is, and they're bringing in a lot of outside assessors, then they can get their waiting lists down. But other areas that aren't putting that effort in are going to start seeing problems when their referrals go up.
And that's the issue as well. We've talked about the postcode lottery in a lot of health issues, and it seems autism is right in there with the rest of the priorities that need to be dealt with. Can I just ask, because I was saying as well that Daisy's added so much to our lives, we've learned so much. Just a wee thing is like, if I'm in a cafe now and I see a child not too happy, I don't immediately go, it's a badly behaved child. That's the things that I learn. You know, I wanted to ask you, what is having autistic children done for you and your life?
Well, my life has gone in a completely different direction because I now run a charity. So yes, I guess it's completely, I mean, we had to completely change our lives because I would, if I hadn't already been self-employed, I would certainly have lost my job because of my child's mental health. And really, although the severity of it has changed since then, the need for flexibility and the need for me to be able to work from home hasn't changed in that point. So I guess you could say it has changed my life a lot in that ways. But also it's made me realise my own neurodivergence and my husband too, although he already suspected. It has made me, I guess, have a massive cultural change. And, you know, like you said, about realizing that it's not bad behavior. I guess I never really thought too much about autism before, but it's made me much more open to all kinds of differences. I often tell the story that when I was 21, I went and I lived in Japan for 3 years. And because Japan is such, or was then, such a different culture, it's really easy to spot the culture differences. And I was on a program that was run by the Japanese government, and it had, UK, US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, people come over. And when you first came over, there was an orientation in a posh hotel in Tokyo. And then when you went each to your own prefectures, which is a county, when you went to each of those, you had another little orientation. And obviously in the posh hotel, you could have anything you liked for breakfast, really. You know, if you wanted bacon and eggs, you could have it. If you wanted croissants, you could have it. If you wanted a Japanese breakfast, which is like rice, or was then, rice, fish, miso soup, a raw egg cracked over it, a bit of seaweed, you could have it. But when we went to the local hotel for our orientation, only the Japanese breakfast was available. And there were about 120 of us, and I don't think more than two people ate the Japanese breakfast. We were all pretty horrified, to be honest with you. Fast forward a year. Sadly, I didn't go back to the pot. You don't get to go to the posh hotel for your second or third year, but you do go to the local orientation. And so then, second year, and especially the third year, it's really interesting. Because you spot all the newbies who've just come, particularly you can spot the American ones. Maybe they are brought up with this idea that their culture is the right way to do things. And we, to some extent, we're all brought up in that way, aren't we? Yeah. The way that we do things in our family, the way that we do things in our school, the way that we do things in our neighbourhood, we believe that that's the right way to do things. But it became very obvious, this kind of cultural divide became very obvious. The second and third years would happily eat the Japanese breakfast, whereas the first years all did the same as we had done in our first year, turned their noses up at it, just horrified that you would be eating fish and rice from seaweed for breakfast. But, you know, you change. It changes you, things, experiences like that. And you become more open and you become more accepting. But most of all, you become more aware that there's not just one right way to do things, but there's multiple ways, right ways to do things. And they're all equally right. And so that's what you have to do when you have, well, it's what everyone should be doing anyway, regardless of whether you have an autistic family member. Everyone should be doing that. We should all be thinking that, okay, I do things this way, but actually her over there does things in a different way, and it's perfectly acceptable.
Kathy, I'm from Scotland. We do everything perfectly. You know, what it got me as well is the more we do these podcasts, the more I find out, and it's great talking to people at yours. You must still have people finding your website for the first time, Autistic Girls Network, and going, oh, I didn't know you were here. Yes. You know, and it's such a, because you've got resources on there as well. I mean, that must be fantastic, but also be a bit frightening that there's still people don't know that places like yours
is
available.
There's loads of people that don't know. And I said, I wrote a whole chapter on this in my book, and said, you know, we were just the same and it's because school, obviously all schools are different, but our school certainly, and I've heard it many, many times since, our school acted as if this was the first time they'd ever come across anything like this. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't put us in touch with anybody. Nobody could tell us, you know, a plan. They were floundering around. They had to talk to their insurance company, health and safety, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we thought that we were on our own. We thought there was nobody else in the country going through this. And of course, that's complete rubbish. There's thousands of people going through this. And that's where the empowerment is, of getting together with other people going through the same things, because you suddenly realise, I am not alone. There are people that will hold me up in this fight, because unfortunately it is a fight. It's a fight in the system. It's fighting the system. It's fighting the system to get the support that your child needs. I wish I could say it wasn't a fight. And I, you know, I hope for the day when we don't need to exist as a charity, and it's all, you know, it's all perfectly accepted. And maybe you don't even need to have a diagnosis. Maybe it's just accepted that we all have different neurotypes, and that's perfectly okay. That would be great, but we're not there yet at the moment.
Last word then, Kathy. Are you optimistic?
Yes, I think so. We're seeing loads more awareness. We're seeing more understanding. You know, look at Chris Packham's program only last week, I don't know, it's on
the BBC iPlayer.
Time passes so quickly. Yeah. You know, look at that. Okay, there was only one woman and there were three males, but, you know, it told her story. She was given the opportunity to tell her story, most importantly. It told the story of Ken Bruce's son, you know, who is non-speaking. That's really, really important. That's groundbreaking, really. And I read this morning that Christine McGuinness is going to have a program, and that's going to be talking about autistic women. And, you know, I might not have anything in common with these people who are making these programs, but I'm really glad that they're being made, because they bring awareness. And, you know, certainly Chris Packham's program had autistic input, you know, all across. Obviously Chris is autistic, the producer was autistic, and I know that they had other autistic people working on it. So I think just listening to autistic people is what we need to be doing.
Really interesting, loads of things. I took loads of notes down when I was doing the interview as well. Late diagnosis was one of the things. She was talking about that 80-year-old lady who'd just been diagnosed, and the fact that girls are still going through that experience. I wonder, do you think we'll ever get to the parity between boys getting diagnosed and girls getting diagnosed?
I think the awareness is helping. Yeah. I think the fact that people like Kathy are doing a lot of work around the fact that girls might be masking and might be autistic but not able to not something that is immediately visible or the signs aren't there.
She talked about internal there's an internal autism because it's not visible in the way that if you're early diagnosed, like with Daisy is very evidently autistic to most people that meet her. You can tell
because she has the classic
traits, and obviously non-speaking, but for a lot of people with autism it's very much an experience that's internal, and people on the outside of that wouldn't necessarily know.
But I think it is about the awareness, isn't it? It's just about the fact that the more we know that this is something that is an issue that with underdiagnosis, the more people are going to look at it, and the more girls who maybe feel different or you know, maybe have noticed some differences in themselves, they're going to know, and they're going to start to question. And then eventually you get to that really lovely place where it kind of doesn't matter either way, and the label is secondary to everything else.
Yeah, I really liked when Kathy, I think you'd asked about hope. I think it was something around the future, and actually she said about hoping that we don't need her charity, we don't need charities like that, and that actually it's... the diagnosis shouldn't be a thing, because it's recognizing that every human being has a different neurotype. And what a wonderful world that would be if we were all just accepted for our individuality and uniqueness without it having to be labeled. That would be an amazing
All right, I'll give you normals now. I see what you mean now.
It's embracing the difference.
Yeah.
But not sort of letting that person feel like they've got to fit into the world.
Yeah.
It's about the world fitting around them.
Just being normal. Everyone is normal in their own way. We are all normal in a different way, and that's okay. I think that's exactly what you strive for, isn't it?
There was a bit as well that
hammers home what an autistic child goes through. Mm. And Kathy mentioned the corridors of hell, you know, that an autistic child goes through, the changeover between classes.
Yeah.
You know, that noise, the bell, and Kathy was talking about the smells. And for sort of an autistic child, that sudden influx of sensory information must be incredibly overwhelming.
Well, we were sort of talking about curriculums and things a little while ago, because I think we were just talking about Daisy and school. And actually, we were sort of saying that teaching and educating children with autism or additional needs is really, really challenging, because you're not just teaching them the thing that you want to teach them. You have to take into account every sensory thing that is affecting them. It might be that they're sitting, it would be like concentrating on a bit of work that's really important, but you've got a telephone ringing, someone blowing in your ear, a loud hoover going off, and the floor underneath you feeling really uneven. And you've got to try and navigate all of that as that individual and take on board what's being taught to you. And the person teaching that has to recognise all of those sensory needs as well. So it's not easy for the individual autistic person, and it's also not easy for the people that are teaching. There needs to be that additional support and that education for the educators. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to say is the thing that I find really sad listening to Kathy as well is the lack of provision for an ordinary curriculum for children with autism. So having the ordinary curriculum, but all the other factors around that to support their sensory needs. There aren't institutions like that. And actually, that's really sad, because children miss out. Daisy may have fitted into a mainstream curriculum, but the environment wouldn't necessarily be right environment for her. So there's something missing.
That's the thing. There was a head teacher through work that we spoke to as part of a piece who just said that when you get it right, these kids become something.
They fly.
They flourish, and they become they go out and work and they own their own houses and they live independently.
Yeah.
When you don't get the education right early, those hopes are dampened. They don't go on to achieve as much because not enough has been put in at the ground level. And it is really, really frustrating to hear that kind of thing, isn't it? Because
it's just really, it's you really look at sad. Daisy
and you just go, genuinely, you know, the fact she doesn't speak aside, I think she's capable of anything. Genuinely do. Like, there's so much intelligence there.
Mm.
It's just about how you enable her to communicate, because obviously she needs to. But it is frustrating when you hear about the horror stories from other parents and Kathy talking about that the corridors of hell. Is shouldn't that always be something that's factored into every child's well-being, whether they have additional needs or not?
There's a fit. I find the sort of mental health side of things, because we've touched upon that in previous podcasts. So I think for me, I hope that because Daisy has had an early diagnosis and we've got support in place, you hope that we can navigate and avoid those mental health issues.
Because Kathy was saying that very often a diagnosis of autism comes out the back of a mental health incident, a crisis.
And you don't want any child to get, child or adult to get to that point where a crisis is what facilitates a diagnosis. Yeah.
There was a fascinating point there, just talking about hopes and dreams. There was a fascinating point there as well about Kathy saying that she doesn't want it to get to a stage where, if you hire an autistic person, that you're not hiring a superpower, right? Because we talk about the superpower all the time, and that expectation puts pressure on.
Yep.
And an autistic person just going, well, I can do this, but don't ask me to be, to do huge sets of numbers. That kind of, that whole idea of the autism we see depicted in some of the
Rain Man
and things like that.
But actually, that's interesting as well, because once you look at what we three, the way we talk about autism, since we started this podcast to now,
is
completely different. Yeah. You're right. We talked about superpowers, and actually, sometimes I sort of listen back and I go, I'm not sure I should have said
I've
that.
I've done that.
But
well, we had it with, it's not non-verbals, no non-speaking.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're learning new...
Well, we've only learnt that through...
Talking to people.
Speaking to Elizabeth and other guests. But the main point of that whole thing is, as long as you're always trying to learn about it, you can't really make mistakes because you can update your language and you can update your outlook. It's just as long as you're trying to actually participate, then you will become better at speaking about it and using the right terminology.
When is your birthday?
My birthday is the 26th of October. When's your birthday?
Yes. When is your birthday? Yes.
When's your birthday? Can you tell me? Remember which button it is?
If I'm upset, when is your birthday? Yes, if I'm upset. My birthday is on the 28th of September.
Your birthday is the 28th of September? Good job.
Vicious cycle as well, that referrals for autism are up.
Yeah.
Which means waiting lists go up as well.
Yeah.
We've talked before about people who maybe don't have access to therapists or advocates, that they are missing out. They're not able. And as that head teacher said to you, Nell, is, you know, once you hit the spot... the fear is that some children will never get that moment of hitting the spot because they haven't gone down that particular road.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that the government are wrestling with at the moment because the number of referrals is so high.
Yeah.
It's unprecedented, the number of children that are asking for EHCPs. And they have just announced new funding, but prior to that, everything was pretty static. Number of special schools, pretty static. Funding was pretty nigh on. This head teacher told us that it'd been about 10,000 per child for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Now, when you think about the cost of everything, 10,000, you know, would have been all right maybe back then. But, you know, it's all got to keep up. And I think actually it goes back to the point earlier about awareness and visibility. Is as long as the conversation is in the mainstream, as long as people are talking about why we need this money and why schools, you know, need more funding and parents need training. More help, then it kind of, you know, something's got to be done eventually.
So much to talk about there with Cathy, and as we keep on saying on the podcast, if you've got any thoughts yourself, listeners, about, you know, your own child or somebody in the family with autism, what kind of support is there? Could it be better? Could it be worse? Is there good practice going on? Right, we better get with the moments of joy out of the way. Who's going to go first? Daisy, moment of joy, please. Lou.
Do you want me to go?
Yeah.
So we took Daisy yesterday. We were supposed to go to the beach, but it was a really bad day weather-wise. So we decided we were going to go on the train and on the bus to Cambridge and just go out for some lunch, weren't we? So we took her vodka with us and we went to an Italian restaurant and we showed her, I mean, she's able to find some of it, but we showed her how to ask for her own lunch. So when the waitress came over, she was able to press speak and out came, "I want spaghetti bolognese, please." And it was just... amazing, because for the first time she was able to ask for what she wanted, and as we were leaving we sort of helped her to program in thank you bye, but she we were sat at the table and she put thank you bye bus train, because she knew we were going to be going on the bus and the train
she's
next.
She's already sequenced
the sentence, but as we were leaving she pressed speak to the waitress thank you bye, and they were like bye, and it was
magic.
It honestly, it sort of gives me goosebumps because it was just so lovely. And actually I have to just say, the look on her face when she asked for her spaghetti bolognese, she looked so proud of herself, didn't she? She had a big grin on her face.
Really proud.
So I thought that was my magic
actually
moment.
I was going to say something else, but reminded me, same. So it's all food related. Yeah. But I ordered tiramisu for my dessert, and Daisy had ice cream. But they brought the tiramisu out, and you should have seen Daisy's eyes. I've never seen them that wide. She looked at it and went. And then I thought, it's got alcohol in it.
I was like, you can't give it to him. I just got alcohol and it's like masala wine or something.
I gave her the tiniest little bit of the corner, and she sort of went.
Oh.
Stuck her tongue out and just took a little bit and then just went, ow, took the whole lot.
You wait and see when she actually learns how to use a vodka, she'll be pressing the button, no, bigger.
yeah, more please.
More please.
Yeah, so that was a lovely day, yes.
Yeah.
Mine this week was we had on Tuesday, we have Daisy after school, and her cousin Libby comes round because her dad takes her to football. So Libby, we pick Libby up, or she comes round for her tea before she goes to football as well. So we'd noticed the two of them were sitting down on the couch. Libby was on the iPad, and Daisy was, I think, on the iPad as well. And Daisy was just putting her hand across onto Libby's leg, just gently touched her. However, I went into the kitchen. I must have been doing some cooking.
Yeah, of course.
I was putting, something together.
Renowned chef.
Ping meal.
I don't know what I was doing. But then all I heard was Ebby as loud. And I just went, what? And I dived in. I said to Denise, did you see? Yeah, she said, that was Libby.
Yeah.
And it was as clear as, because, you know, I always think when your kids are growing up, especially when they're learning to talk, you kind of put words in, they go, well, I think you said daddy there. But that was, it was Ebby, it was Libby there. And it was just clear. It was just great. And again, we went, did you just say Libby? And he puts a smile on.
Yeah.
Sometimes she just kind of teases us.
She knows.
It's like every so often, there's just this little burst. Because there's that. And then the only other word that sometimes we get that sounds like anything is when she really doesn't want something and it comes out in anger. It's a no, isn't it? But it's, oh, and you can hear she's trying to force that word out. Yeah. So I think there's just those little moments where there's a connection to her. Yeah, just something that it just works. But
it means you're gonna have to watch your language in the car.
You always talk about me like I swear all the time. Whoa, I don't at all.
We don't want those words that you say coming out of my mouth.
I don't care which one. I'll give her as much money as I've got in the bank.
If she comes out with a swear word,
I'll give her the money.
I'll be right with that. Yeah. Middle of town.
It'd be even better in the right context.
Yeah, exactly. Great.
As I said earlier, if you want to get in touch with us, contact us by the email.
DaisyandMePodcast@gmail.com or Twitter is DaisyandMePod.
Thank you very much for listening.
I think it's, by the way, just quickly, before you wrap up, it's ironic, isn't it, that this episode's called Normals. Yeah. We haven't addressed the fact that he's not.
He's our normal, though.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, you see.
You're really not normal.
You see what I'm up against, kids. Hey, by the way, my hip's coming on a treat.
I was waiting for that.
My knee, if there's any surgeons out there, it'll do it for nothing on the private. Wink, wink. You know, I'll give you a mention on the podcast. Then if you'd like to fix my knee, then give me a shout, please, because that's all I need done.
He's a terrible patient.
Yes. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.